It's a pleasure to welcome you to this talk, both those of you who are here in person and people who are participating online. I'm Al Telser, class of 61 and 67. I stayed on and got a PhD in biochemistry. I'd like to cover a bit of the history of these webcasts to go over some administrative details and then introduce our speaker, Dr. Matthew Turrell. My classmate Howard Czar had the idea of hosting a webcast in the Kathleen Czar room of the Creerar Library for members of the class of 1961. Howard and Barbara Jacobson, our class correspondent, worked with both the university and Creerar staff during the fall of 2011, arranging the first of our webcasts, which was held early last December. The speaker then was Dr. Emily Teeter, a research associate at the Oriental Institute and curator of an exhibit that was on display at that time called Before the Pyramids. She gave us insights into the crafts and consumer goods and consumerism, so to speak, in ancient Egypt. The talk was very interesting, and it was fun for those of us classmates and UFC people who attended to reconnect with people we had gone to school with, even though we may not have actually known them at the time. I attended that talk and have been involved with Roberta and Howard since then in developing more of these webcasts. Today, we're very pleased to have this room that you just heard about, the Kathleen Czar Room, which is really a very comfortable facility. We had lunch, those of you that weren't with us out there, together, and now we're sitting here about to participate in the webcast that Professor Turrell will actually be giving us. For the last 6 months or more, we've worked with Blair Ufer, who many of you have seen her name on emails, who is in the Alumni Relations and Development Department. We wanted to develop these occasional webcasts, something akin to the Common Core programs that are held for alumni who attend University of Chicago reunions every June, but to do it in a way that, first of all, happened a little more frequently throughout the year and to make them available to people who aren't actually on campus. So we thought that rather than just confining it or restricting it to our own class of 61, we would extend it plus and minus 2 years, the classes of 59 through 63, because those of us from those years were on campus about at the same time and we share common experiences, had similar professors and courses and so on, make the whole activity a bit more interesting for everybody. We thought it would be nice to be able to hear from current faculty at the university who are doing all kinds of exciting things, as they did back when we were here as students. We may or may not have known about that, but they were. At the conclusion of the webcast today, we're going to ask people who are in attendance to fill out an evaluation form, and those who are out watching this on the internet will be getting a communication from Blair with the same questions, because we'd like to have your feedback to help us plan for future programs. Blair will be acting as moderator today. She will connect questions via email or Twitter. She will help screen and put the questions together for a short time after Professor Turrell's talk. And for those in the room, Howard and I are gonna be standing on the sides of the room at the end with wireless mics. So those of you in the room can also ask questions. We're gonna wanna be sure that you use the microphone so people who are not with us in the room will be able to hear. So, on to Professor Turrell. First, it is really a pleasure to introduce our speaker, Professor Matthew Turrell. The founding, I'm gonna read a lot of boilerplate, shouldn't say boilerplate, credentials, I'll say. Right, boilerplate something else, forget that. the founding Pritzker Director of the Institute for Molecular Engineering at the University of Chicago. And those of us from our day might raise an eyebrow, engineering at the University of Chicago. It is, in fact, a really new thing. He is a senior scientist at Argonne National Laboratory. Pay attention to this next string of words because it's going to be on the exam. He specializes in polymer surface properties, adsorption, adhesion, surface treatment, friction, lubrication, biocompatibility, and self-assembly. It's coming up again later. In 2009, Professor Perel became the Arnold and Barbara Silverman Professor and Chair of Bioengineering at the University of California, Berkeley, with additional appointments in chemical engineering and material science and engineering, and as a faculty scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. He served in these capacities until taking his current appointment here at the university in 2011. From 1977 to 1999, Professor Terrell was a member of the Chemical Engineering and Material Science faculty at the University of Minnesota, where he served as department head from 1995 through 99. From 99 to 2009, he was Dean of Engineering and Professor of Chemical Engineering and Materials at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Professor Terrell has co-authored approximately 300 papers and one book during his career. He has supervised about 80 PhD students and about 40 postdoctoral fellows. His honors include membership in the National Academy of Engineering, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the Indian National Academy of Engineering. He has been a Sloan and Guggenheim Fellow, a Camille and Henry Dreyfus Teacher Scholar, and a Fellow of the American Institute of Medical and Biological Engineers, of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the American Physical Society. From the American Institute of Chemical Engineers, Professor Terrell has received the Alan P. Colburn Award, the Charles Stein Award, and the William H. Walker Award, and the Professional Progress Awards. He was the Institute Lecturer in 2001. Additionally, Matt has served as a member of the boards of directors of the Santa Barbara Cottage Hospital System and the Camille and Henry Dreyfus Foundation. He received a BS in Chemical Engineering at Northwestern University and a PhD from the University of Massachusetts in Polymer Science in 1977. Now on a little bit to a prelude to today's talk. Those of you who pay attention to these things will note that the popular press and news media, broadcast media, often present research advances in the general and rather new field of nanotechnology as having great promise for the treatment or cure for a number of important human diseases. They're all important. Matthew Terrell will tell us about his research, recent research directed at techniques to identify early vascular plaques using molecular engineered nanomaterials. Through his talk, I hope that we will gain a better understanding of current research in molecular engineering and nanotechnology. Matt will also tell us about the university's exciting new Institute for Molecular Engineering, its new faculty, its program, and goals. It's a pleasure to be able to learn about work from this work from one of the premier researchers in this area and to learn about the work he will lead at the new Institute for Molecular Engineering. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Matthew Terrell.
Thank you very much, Alan. Thank you to those of you who are here and those of you who are online. It's always an opportunity to talk to people who have such a history themselves with this institution that I'm new at. I want to take pains to add that, you know, we're trying to add to the institution. We're not trying to revolutionize the University of Chicago because it's been doing well for more than a century and a quarter or so. I think what we're doing is an incremental change, but an important one, I think. As Al said, I'm going to start off by talking about our own work to give you a concrete example of the kinds of things that could and do and will constitute molecular engineering. And I've made up this particular name for what we do, and I also want to try to be careful to give credit because this has been done with a group of graduate students and postdocs over the last few years. We call the particles that we're making that I'm going to explain to you protein analogous micelles. They're a form of tiny particle that we believe can deliver some interesting effects in healthcare diagnoses and therapeutics. This is what a research group looks like in most of the labs of molecular engineering. I don't have one from the University of Chicago, and some of these people have moved on, but the work I'm going to talk about quickly integrates over the work of about six graduate students and postdocs, Rachel Marullo, Amanda Trent, Brian Lynn, Mark Castantine, Matt Black, and Dimitri Miserlis, many of whom have moved on to other productive activities in the world of science and engineering. But basically, what I'm going to tell you about for the next 10, 15 minutes are aggregated nanoparticles that we make by self-assembly, using some of the keywords that were in the introduction. That means spontaneous formation in solution of molecules that look structurally like this, that have a piece of protein, that is a short sequence of amino acids, synthetically, in our own lab, chemically linked to a hydrophobic tail. And when you make molecules like that, the hydrophobic part confers the self-assembly character onto these molecules. In these pictures are some of the possible uses of self-assembled structures incorporating short pieces of proteins. So one can get molecules like this to spontaneously organize on surfaces. You can get them to make things that resemble cell membranes but are not living cells, but they organize into bilayer membranes. Or they organize themselves into objects like this that we call protein analogous micelles. And I'll keep explaining this as we go along. A micelle might not be familiar to you as we first start to talk about it, but these are the things that form in your kitchen sink or in your washing machine when you put detergent or soap or something like that in. And these molecules that have a water-loving part and a hydrophobic part, a water-hating part, make little globules that have a greasy interior, and that's what's here, and a water-loving exterior. When they're functioning as soap and detergent, the purpose of the greasy interior is to solubilize the grease and take it out of your clothing or dishes or something like that. In our case, the purpose of the greasy interior is to hold these things together in water so that they stick together. The analogy with protein molecules that we're trying to exploit and use in various ways is that the shape of a protein molecule is formed by some of the same physics and physical chemistry that make our micelles. Proteins take on their characteristic shape by putting their water-hating hydrophobic amino acids in the middle and then displaying the hydrophilic amino acids around the periphery. We do this in a similar way by having a hydrophobic tail on the molecule, and that brings together a collection of 80 to 100 of these molecules in a micelle with these biological bits on the outside. And so what we're trying to do is create a synthetic particle, every element of which we synthesize in our lab, that makes some of the functions of proteins possible with a controlled man-made structure. Of course, there's other ways to do this. There are people that know how to engineer proteins and make them differently. But I'm going to show you some examples of situations where we think the man-made synthetic nanoparticle is a better choice. These things, as I said, have a hydrophobic core and a hydrophilic shell, and they're about the same size. We call these nanoparticles because the typical size is 1 to 10 nanometers, which means 1 to 10 one billionths of a meter. So this is really tiny. We're talking about way smaller than human hairs or whatever, you know, kind of physical feel you have for smallness. This is way smaller. This is, you know, only about one order of magnitude up from atomic length scales. So that's the size that we're talking about. There are differences, and it's really these differences that we want to exploit with these objects to try to do better. And the most important difference that I'm going to talk about is what I call here in kind of technical terms, high multivalency and multifunctionality. We can put 80 to 100 of these little biological fragments into this, and they don't all have to be the same. We can make mixed micelles, so we can incorporate into an object like this a function that would cause these things to target pathological tissue, and another function that would cause some signal that could be used for diagnosis, and another function that might create some kind of therapeutic effect or something like that. But what we're really exploiting is the fact that we have a concentrated display of 80 to 100 peptide molecules in a small geographical region. So we've been thinking about what kinds of biological functionality, what kinds of biomedical functionality could we really deliver with molecules or assemblies such as this. And I'm going to talk about two. One is the one that Al alluded to in his introduction about targeting pathological tissue. But before I do that, I'm going to talk about something that's much more recent and exciting to us, which is to try to make synthetic vaccines. The way vaccines are typically made is to take a virus that is responsible for a particular disease, smallpox or other kinds of things, and kill it, render it inactive and incapable of replicating, which essentially means stripping out some of the biological functionality that allows it to replicate itself, but leaving the protein coat intact. A virus is a nanoparticle. It is a biologically synthesized particle, typically a little bigger than the ones we make, but it displays an array of proteins, and that's what produces the stimulation of the immune response, so that if you're immunized against smallpox, you don't get smallpox, because your immune system has been stimulated so that it knows how to kill the smallpox virus if you're exposed to it. What we've been trying to figure out is, can we use an object like one of these micelles to stimulate the immune system to do other things? And so I'm going to show you our very early experiments. This is a tough job. I mean, what we're basically doing is using a nanoparticle like this. In this case, it's not a sphere, by the way. It's a short rod. That doesn't matter too much for this particular application. If we wanted to make it a sphere, we could. But what we're trying to do is essentially produce an effective delivery system to expose, in our case, the animal that we're immunizing, to a dense array of these peptides so that it knows, when it sees this peptide again, kill that thing that is bearing these peptides. And that's tough. But this delivery system that we have is aimed at concentrating the antigen, that means the peptide, protecting it from being degraded before it can stimulate any immune response, increase its processing by the immune system, and induce the production of chemicals that actually create a robust immune response. And so I'm going to show you an example where we've made a self-assembled aggregate of molecules just like I showed you before. We take a short peptide, and this is the sequence of amino acids. And this is actually a sequence that's found in egg albumin. So you would actually find this in the predominant protein in eggs. So ova is what this peptide is sometimes called, or sometimes called synfecal. Don't worry about that. And we make a self-assembled aggregate of these things, micelles, and we can see these things. This is an electron micrograph, and this is an atomic force micrograph. So here we're taking an image using electrons instead of light to image these things. Here we're actually running a little tip over it and feeling the little rods that you can see in atomic force microscopy. And here's a whole bunch of results, but I'm just going to point out the most important part. We do these experiments so far in mice, and we take a suspension of the micelles that I just showed you and inoculate the mice on day 0, day 10, and day 20. And then on day 30, we inject into the mice a suspension of biologically engineered cancer cells that display the egg albumin protein on their surface. So it's a little bit cheating. We've made these cancer cells responsive to the thing. But this is a proof of principle. We could do this with other things. If the whole idea works, then we can do it with other peptides. And if we don't do anything, if the inoculations we give have only buffer or only the peptide in an emulsion, basically, then in fact the tumors grow rapidly, and when they get to a certain point, something like 100 square millimeters, the protocols require terminating the experiment. But you can see that when we inoculate these mice with our micelles, the progress of the tumor growth is significantly delayed, and the lifespan of the mice is significantly increased. Not forever. I mean, these mice, the tumor still grows and the mice still die. But we can prove that, in fact, we are activating a robust immune response. And here I'll get into some of the details. But what we are counting are the percentage of cells that are called cytotoxic T cells that are actually capable of killing these cancer cells. So our job is to increase this number of cells above this line to a bigger number. And that's a direction we're working in. But the proof of principle that a synthetic object can act as a man-made, not biologically derived vaccine, I think is interesting and potentially useful. Because there's lots of problems with virus-derived vaccines. They, even though they're killed and don't replicate, they sometimes produce bad reactions. Of course, I don't know that our stuff doesn't produce bad reactions either, but we'll figure all that out. The other thing, which was alluded to in the direction, is to try to have nanoparticles such as this on patrol, looking for pathologies. And that's one of the reasons that we want to make small spherical particles. If you inject substantially sized spheres, things that might be maybe not grains of sand, but something approaching more macroscopic size, lots of things happen to eliminate those things before they can ever travel through the circulation to get to the site of a pathological situation. The spleen is a filter that filters them out. The body produces all sorts of proteins that activate big white cells called macrophages that come in there and engulf and eliminate some of these things. So it's a difficult job to get something through. Smaller is generally better, and so these nanoparticles are particularly effective at avoiding detection. Now, this idea that one might have little nanoparticles on patrol in the circulation has been current in the science and engineering literature for 10 years. But there hasn't been a great deal of success, in part, not in total, because of inability to make particles as small as we're able to make them. But the idea is that these things could circulate. When a blood vessel goes through a tumor, the cancer cells in the tumor would create some kind of signal that could be picked up by the biological functionality that we put on the periphery of these things, that we would have peptides in these particles that was sensitive to something that it saw or felt in the vicinity of the tumor. And to that end, we've been making micelles that look like this, with the peptide being a much simpler one than the one I showed you in the vaccines. It's just a 5-amino acid thing, and it's simpler when you're talking about things if the vowels and the consonants of the single-letter amino acid code are in the right place to say the name of the peptide. So we call this one CRECA, but it's really cysteine, arginine, glutamate, lysine, alanine. And that's why we don't say that. We call it CRECA. And we put a fluorescent label on it, and then a big hydrophobic tail. And the thing that's different that I haven't mentioned so far in this application to create these tumor-targeting protein-analogous micelles is that we put a big hydrophilic spacer between the peptide that targets the tumor, and I'll tell you how in a second, and the hydrophobic tail, and that's to drive this thing into a small circular shape. It might be counterintuitive that in order to get a small circular shape, you put a big fat polymer on there, but the reason is that this polymer loves water, it swells in water, and it drives these things. It swells the corona, so these things want to spread out, and that makes it spherical instead of cylindrical. The peptide was discovered by a colleague of mine at the University of California by a technique called in vivo phage display. So he took viruses that display libraries of peptides and injected them into mice that had certain diseases. I'm going to show you breast cancer and atherosclerosis, and found that this peptide homed to tumors and to atherosclerotic plaques, and specifically it homed there because it homes to blood clots. This CRCA peptide has a high affinity to clotted blood, and it turns out that essentially all solid tumors have blood clots in them because the vasculature in a rapidly growing tumor is poorly formed and it leaks. So there's microscopic blood clots distributed throughout solid tumors in most cases. And I'll talk about this a little bit more, but there are also microscopic blood clots on the surfaces of atherosclerotic plaque. So we can actually use this same assembly to target both conditions. So the experiment isn't a particularly attractive one to talk about, but what we do is xenograft breast tumor tissue into mice and allow it to engraft for a couple of weeks. And then we're ready to do the experiment. We take a suspension of our mice cells and inject them into the tail vein. So we're not injecting this anywhere near the site of the tumor at all. It has to travel through the circulation. And in this case, we sacrifice the animal after 3 hours, extract the organs, and look at where the fluorescence is so we can tell where it's going. And to make a long story short, there is strong accumulation of our fluorescently labeled micelles in the tumor. This is a surgical excision of the tumor tissue. The blue stains the nuclei of the cells in the tumor tissue. This is what happens if you don't have CRCA on the micelles. You have everything else in the micelle that I showed you, but not the peptide, and nothing gets to the tumor then. So it's not just an accident that this stuff is accumulating there. It's attracted to this. The red is staining for blood clots, and so there's a strong localization of our micelles with blood clots in the tumor tissue. And we've done this many times. These are examples where I'm showing you the cells of the tumor and the targeting micelles separately and then overlaying them. There's a fair amount in the liver, which is something to pay attention to. You can't do a lot of things that cause a buildup of foreign chemicals in your liver very often. So whether this is toxic or something to worry about will be the subject of further study. But notice that we get more of it in the tumor than we do in the liver. The other thing that's kind of interesting is we get almost none of it in the spleen and almost none of it in the heart, lung, brains, kidneys, you name it. It's in the tumor and in the liver to some extent. If we don't sacrifice the animals, most of this does go out eventually over about 8 hours in urine from the mice. So we have a pretty effective, if not perfectly selective, vehicle for targeting tumors. Now we're trying to think about what to do with them. And this is where, so part of the reason these things stick to blood clots so well and accumulate is not only that the CRCA peptide likes to stick to blood clots, but our micelle has 80 to 100 CRCAs in it. So there's a multiplicative factor of the affinity per molecule times 80 to 100, which gives a very high avidity of our micelles for the tumor. So now we're thinking about, can we put some killer peptides in there? The idea would be that if we get the accumulation due to the tumor-targeting peptide, then we can turn off, we can cause a simple way of thinking about cancer cells is that they don't die naturally. Apoptosis is a natural cell death mechanism. And there are some potent apoptosis-inducing peptides, meaning cell-killing peptides. The problem is they'll kill every cell that they come into contact with. So we're trying to think of, can we make an assembly that has the tumor targeting and a protective layer of this polyethylene glycol that's the same as this hydrophilic polymer, such that these things aren't revealed until these micelles have accumulated in the tumor. We're about to try this in animals, actually, but we've done it in the lab. And to make a long story short, you don't have to look at this in great detail. These are two different kinds of cells. And if we have these cells growing in a cell culture dish, and we put a micelle that has this protective layer and this killer peptide on it, and we let it sit there for 24 hours, most of the cells die in either case. But if we wash it off after 2 hours, and this is this micelle containing a high concentration of these potent cell-killing peptides, none of the cells have died, basically. So there's some chance for what I'm talking about, at least from cell culture in so-called in vitro experiments. We're going to try to move this into animals. Let me finish up with the plaque example. Atherosclerotic plaque is the buildup of lipids in the blood vessel wall. There's a synergy between inflammation and the buildup of lipids. One seems to catalyze the other, so that the deposition of lipid introduces inflammation, and more inflammation causes more deposition of lipid. But the really dangerous situation is not one where the plaque continues to grow stably, because that generally produces symptoms of some kind of pain. The situation that's difficult and that we're trying to detect is what's called vulnerable or unstable plaque, that is one in which before it grows too big, there's a massive rupture event, and this can lead to clotting and a massive thrombosis and possibly a deadly heart attack. And it's a more of a challenge because, as I said, it doesn't present any symptoms. And we have these vulnerable plaques have clotted plasma proteins because before they massively rupture, they rupture a little bit, and a blood clot comes in to try to repair that little rupture. So we have a vehicle that targets blood clots. And there's a different animal model here. Mice don't get atherosclerosis. Mice only live 2 years, and they die of old age after 2 years. So I don't know if that's related or not. But if you take the genes that make high-density lipoproteins away from the mice, then they do get atherosclerosis. And so you're looking at the lumen of coronary blood vessels in a wild-type mouse and in this knockout mouse, both of whom, in order to condition this mice, have been fed a high-fat diet for several weeks. And these cell coverings are covering up lipid deposits in the blood vessel lining of these mice. And so we do the same experiment. Once these mice are conditioned, we inject a suspension of our micelles and sacrifice the animal after 3 hours, and then look at its blood vessels, and you can see that the coronary blood vessels just light up with green fluorescence. The lumen of this, I'm not a physician, so I don't really know what degree of occlusion corresponds to detectable symptoms in a patient, but I'm willing to guess that this mouse wasn't experiencing chest pain, even though there's significant plaque buildup. There's a significant open area here too, so blood was flowing to this mouse, but clearly we can detect the presence of these plaques. There's some control experiments that I won't get into. So we really think we have something here, and in fact it's this application that we are focusing on. We can actually tell exactly where these things accumulate, and it's right in the corner where the plaque separates from the rest of the blood vessel wall. It corresponds very well to regions of high inflammation and to regions of high clotted plasma proteins. So we've been consulting with cardiologists here, something I wasn't able to do quite as conveniently at Berkeley or at Santa Barbara, and have taken on some new directions, in particular to try to move to a situation where we could detect this before it's gone so far. I mean, this is already a pretty advanced stage of this. We would like to really be able to detect the incipient formation of these kind of plaques. And what could you do? I mean, then think about therapy. One thing you could think about would be stenting in a particular region. If you knew that something was developing in a small region, a surgeon can go in there, or a cardiologist can go in there and place a stent to secure the area where there might be some problem. I put up this eye chart here really only to point out the title. This is a review article from last year that lists all the situations that this author could find where nanoparticles were used for the treatment or diagnosis of atherosclerosis. It's about 20 examples, less than 20. If you did the same thing with cancer, nanoparticles for cancer, you'd need a scroll that went from here to I don't know where, the Gulf of Mexico. There are thousands of attempts to use nanoparticles for cancer. So we're moving to what we think is, you know, an equally important application that's somewhat less studied. So we like these things. We think they're versatile and that we can use them for protein mimicking functionality, and that there's a lot of interesting applications both in the science areas that I didn't talk about protein folding, but to targeted diagnostics and therapeutics. So that's the introduction to my own research. I'm going to take a few minutes and introduce you to the Institute for Molecular Engineering, because it really is unique, even not only for the University of Chicago, but even in the world of engineering. When you say you're doing molecular engineering, not everybody knows what you're talking about. They think maybe you're a synthetic organic chemist or something, and you're engineering individual molecules. And what we really mean is we're engineering with synthetic molecular building blocks. We're building from the molecular level up to try to create properties that are interesting from the electronic, optical, mechanical, chemical, or biological point of view, and creating functional systems that are macroscopic, including manufacturing by biological routes to new ways of doing computing. And our aim is to essentially merge the ideas of an academic research institute with an educational academic department. They call us the Institute for Molecular Engineering. We could have been called the Department of Molecular Engineering. We're about that size. But Institute kind of captures the dual mission of interdisciplinarity and autonomy, because we do have the capacity to hire our own faculty and so on. One of the things we're doing is kind of bringing out in the environment of the University of Chicago how engineering is a little bit different from science. Our job is to accelerate how science is used in society, and they're not the same thing. You know, science is about curiosity and nature and discovery and figuring out how the world works, and engineering is about design and application and invention and changing how the world works. But they're certainly cooperative. There's a really interesting book, if any of you are interested in kind of history of science and understanding science. The name of the book is called Pasteur's Quadrant. It was written by a Princeton historian of science who died a few years ago, Donald Stokes. But he kind of divided technical work in science of engineering into four quadrants, based on whether it was aimed at understanding things fundamentally and whether it was brought in considerations of practical utility. Everybody tries to stay away from the no-no quadrant. I don't know that there's any other way to validate scientific. Maybe there's a third axis, you know, but anyway. But, you know, his idea was that Edison did things in a completely, as we now say, Edisonian way. Aimed at practical utility, not really creating fundamental understanding. Niels Bohr, the great high-energy physicist, aimed at understanding and didn't particularly drive toward practical utility. But Pasteur was a brilliant chemist and microbiologist in France who made some great scientific discoveries, but also was a consultant to the fermentation industry. And some of the things he learned about microbiology and chiral crystals and so on came out of his work with the fermentation industry. And so instead of thinking about technological development as just strictly science push, we are thinking about it as a kind of a cyclic interaction between science and engineering. And I think I and my colleagues are into this complementarity between science and engineering. So engineering is the path from science to society, and the motivating idea is to exploit or bring to bear molecular-level science for solutions to societal problems in energy, healthcare, information technology, environment, and any other important things that we can think of. There was a long planning process here at the University of Chicago before I came on the scene early in 2011. I actually showed up here 15 months ago in late July of 2011. But the planning process had been going on for 4 years or so, and, you know, conceived of this idea of molecular engineering before I came, and was thinking about what could it produce. New molecular electronic devices, new bio-inspired materials, new membranes, new therapeutics and stuff, and I agree that these are good things. The planning process suggested that when the new director came, we should pick some of these themes and run with them and hire theme leaders, but that didn't seem quite right to me. I was really thinking more about how do you get the right expertise into a group like this. And I was thinking, and this is how we're pursuing it, that what we needed to do was to build teams that spanned the appropriate expertise to do engineering at the molecular level, that we aren't going to be creating different departments of engineering within molecular engineering. But we need expertise in how to make materials, how to manipulate biology, how to image, how to catalyze reactions, how to process things, and how to compute things. And that's the kind of expertise that we need so that we can do these things. And we have 25 appointments, and that seems feasible. But it's not going to look like any other engineering department anywhere else in the world. Elements of this exist in many engineering departments everywhere. The collection that we're creating doesn't exist anywhere. So I'm happy to introduce our first new faculty member, who's Juan DePablo, sitting in the back of the room there. Joined us from the University of Wisconsin, an expert in molecular modeling, thermodynamics, statistical mechanics, polymer physics, nanostructured materials by design. And we're especially lucky that he joined us along with his University of Wisconsin colleague, Paul Neely, who's an experimentalist who works on patterning organic materials for a variety of applications. And together, they have made huge strides in applying these ideas of self-assembly, the same things, the same general idea that forms our micelles. They've been able to apply to the lithographic processes that are used to create patterns in integrated circuits for computer chips. Working with Intel and Hitachi and other companies, they've figured out how to make patterns. They've also figured out how to, well, in order to, their way of making patterns is to make a template that is replicated in the material. But in some ways, most importantly, they've figured out how to make templates that when you put the polymer on them, make a smaller scale structure than the template itself, which is very important because we're getting to the end of what's called Moore's Law, where we can no longer directly make the patterns. They're too small. The end of Moore's Law is about at the level that I talked about the 10 nanometer level. And these guys, the semiconductor industry, believes that this may be one of the techniques that can get us down to that small-scale structure. Semiconductor circuits aren't made out of dots. They know how to make lines, too. They know how to make bended lines and curved lines, so they can really do it all. The third hire who will join us on January 1st is David Auchalom, who's a physicist and electrical engineer from the University of California, Santa Barbara. Some people have asked me, are you only hiring people you know? And I mean, one of my answers is if I don't know them after being around the field for 35 years, they probably aren't that good anyway. So yes, I'm hiring people that I know, at least at the senior level. hiring junior people, which we'll get to, is a whole other story. You really have to investigate things. And David is an expert in quantum mechanics as it's manifest, not in, you know, the Higgs boson, whatever that is, or what, you know, but rather in semiconductor devices, using quantum mechanical phenomena in the bulk to address spins and so on. And he's been one of the leaders in what's called spintronics that is widely thought to be something that will take the place of computing when we, by digital computation, when we get to the end of Moore's law. That is, instead of using simple ones and zeros, we can use the whole probability spectrum of quantum mechanics to try to do computing. And don't ask me any questions about that, okay? I'll skip over that. So how are the themes shaping up with this way of hiring talent instead of themes? With Juan and Paul and me, we certainly have some strength in self-assembling and biomimicking materials. We're developing one in quantum information engineering with David. We're working on some other hires that relate to these ideas of engineering applied to understanding the immune system. And there's one other one that we haven't acted on yet, but there's a big proposal coming out of Argonne that might get funded by the Department of Energy called an energy storage hub that would bring $25 million here, focused in Chicago. And if that happens, we will certainly hire people in the energy storage area to further our cooperation with Argonne, batteries and things like that. So, you know, we're moving quickly. There's four of us now. I think we'll have 5 to 8 in the first 2 years. We are already offering research experiences and projects for undergraduates, and I don't think we've all made a firm commitment to this, but we're close to saying that we're going to offer an elective course for undergraduates in the spring quarter. Ron's smiling, We're going to seek approval to launch a graduate program this year, an undergraduate program next year, and we want to build connections because, I mean, one of the most important things, and you are, among others, proof of this, the real reputation of an academic program is what the people who go through it eventually do in life, and we really need to help make those connections very effectively. So the opportunity is to create a powerful new kind of engineering program that transcends traditional disciplines from the start, will focus on engineering systems from the molecular level up, and create world-leading programs in areas of interest to society. I think we can leap ahead of traditional engineering schools by this model of not focusing on what the traditional engineering disciplines are. You know, when I worked in chemical engineering departments, we would bemoan the fact that we couldn't keep the students for 5 or 6 years and add, you know, 5 or 10 more chemical engineering courses because they needed so much more chemical engineering to be effective. We have a little different philosophy here. We're going to talk about what you can do with what you do know, not overloading people with more than they need to know. And we really want to take advantage of the breadth of education that one can get, not only in technical subjects, but in economics and social sciences and so on at the University of Chicago. So we have 4 people on board. We're talking actively with 2 more and considering 2 further more seriously in areas ranging from new materials to quantum information to cancer therapy. Serious discussions with a wide array of companies. Many of you have met Sharon Feng, who is our executive director, who started on September 15th, who brings a great wealth of scientific and industrial and managerial experience to us. And we also have a financial manager. So we're starting to look like a regular bureaucracy. So. This is my last slide. You know, the aim is to really become a destination for people seeking a distinctive approach to engineering research and education embedded in a campus with a superb liberal arts education, but in a city and in an environment that has tremendous and growing resources for technological innovation. So that's my story on both counts, my personal story and the IME story. Be happy to have questions now from people who are here, and please use the microphone so people off-site can hear what you have to say. And those of you off-site can be tweeting and emailing questions to us, and they'll be picked up soon.
I have a question. The idea of self-assembly is very intriguing to me, and I can't picture how you take these hydrophobic elements in the little spiral guys that go around the outside. I mean, do you mix them together in a bowl? Give us some idea of how you do this.
Yeah, that's a really excellent question, frankly. And you don't always do it the same way. I mean, but my cells, this is a well-known physical chemistry fact.
Your mic, okay.
Yeah, I think I'm mic'd. Yeah, thanks. There is what's called a critical micelle concentration. So molecules like I showed you will dissolve in water as individual molecules, but not aggregate until you get them to a certain concentration. So there's a trigger that is caused by concentration that causes these micelles to form spontaneously at what's called a CMC or a critical micelle concentration. So yes, in many of the cases, you can just mix them together in a bowl. Sometimes some elements of them are too hydrophobic or something like that, and so you might have to start out by putting them in a mixed solvent that reduces the that's able to handle more hydrophobic things and keep them in solution, as opposed to them falling in a chunk to the bottom of the beaker where you can't do anything with them.
You used the hydrophobic, hydrophilic aspects of polarized molecules, like water being polarized. There are people I know are working with DNA, which DNA attached to these things has a code on it that you can hook to other things specifically and build in the same sense spontaneously. You haven't mentioned that. I'm sure you must have some program on that.
Yeah, the thing about the kind of self-assembly you were just asking me about that's different in DNA is that in water, any hydrophobic things stick together. They're driven by the fact that they want to get out of water. And at a certain concentration, you have so many molecules that are hydrophobic that are exposed to water that it's better if they just shield themselves by getting together, that they reduce their adverse interactions. So, but any hydrophobic thing, to a first approximation, sticks to any other hydrophobic thing. The thing that DNA introduces is programmability and addressability, so that only this sequence sticks with its partner sequence. And yeah, there are people that are thinking about how to incorporate programmable and addressable self-assembly into materials. I'm not doing it, and so far there's only two of us here. We do a lot of things with DNA, actually, even in my group, but not so much on that program self-assembly right now. But it's an active thing.
The interdisciplinary aspect of this is, I think, thrilling. So I'm curious about how you are interacting with the physics department, the biological sciences, and how is this going to work, actually?
Yeah, that's also a fantastic question. So I didn't emphasize, but it's true, that we are our own academic unit. We're not part of the physical sciences division or the biological sciences division. That's partly so that we can have our own start to creating engineering. It's partly, really, comes from the fact that the administration wants to make it clear that new positions are being allocated for engineering, as opposed to rearranging the faculty and creating engineering from what we've already got. Because we could, and that gets right to your point. Even though there isn't engineering here, there's probably 30 or 40 people on this campus that would fit my definition of molecular engineering. And we're reaching out to those people. They've, a lot of them, I've engaged 12 people in the faculty recruitment process who've been really helpful in identifying and persuading people to come. We aren't making joint appointments yet, but we will. Because I think, frankly, I think especially if we hire a few more
sort of in this mode of picking our own people, we will have established the idea that we are capable of doing it and that we are an independent academic unit, but we don't want to be too independent. You know, we want to have porous connections. So Juan and Paul and I, the guys who are here, have dozens of interactions with people in chemistry and physics. And the one big thing that I guess I really haven't mentioned yet is that we are also, it sort of came up in my introduction, but not only me, but all of the other faculty members are also senior scientists at Argonne. So we're really trying to exploit the connection with Argonne as well.
Blair? We have a question from Twitter. It's from David M. Pickett. His question is, what would the elective class for undergraduate students cover?
Yeah. I'll get back to you on that. Seriously, we're probably going to call it Introduction to Molecular Engineering, and I think it'll be a combination of highlights of modern molecular engineering, sort of like the one I gave at the beginning, but you know, perhaps broken down a lot more, so that the students can understand. We'll have more time. You know, we'll have 30 or 40 hours to talk with them instead of 45 minutes. And bringing out some of the things that are distinctive about engineering. So, you know, even though the example that I showed you about nanoparticles sort of sounds like an application, it's really more science at the stage that it is now. It's driven by an application, but I don't know about the toxicity. I don't know about the duration of the lifetime of these things. These are all things that an engineer needs to know. You need to know how to specify the properties of what you're making. And so we want to bring in some of the design aspects. We want to bring in some of the economic aspects to students that you know, may be taken by a scientific idea, but there's a big difference between a good scientific idea and a good technological idea. So we'll try to bring out some of those things, too.
I'll ask a question, if that's okay.
Please.
You mentioned how you've connected with Argonne in terms of energy, and you mentioned the 40 people that you've identified that you're beginning to work with. So especially in the medical area with, for example, I don't know, synthetic vaccines, where your work is just in a research stage, how do you see that proceeding, and do you think that work would be done in the hospital, or would it be done in your institute, or would it be done elsewhere?
Well, I for some of the biomedical applications, you know, there's almost an infinite amount of time you can spend in our labs, let's say, in the institute, refining this or that idea. But if you want to get really serious about it, you have to start talking to real doctors and figuring out what are some of the constraints on what is actually useful to them. So I see, at least from our own work, and certainly some of the other bioengineers who might come here, the idea would be that we keep going on the fundamental new ideas, but as we think something starts to get ready for prime time, we try to get a physician partner to help us move it more toward clinical things. I mean, the sort of sequence is, you know, lab, cell culture, animals, humans, and we're not anywhere close to humans yet, even with our stuff.
So, can I ask a question about more oriented toward the science you talked about? Your synthetic vaccine idea was fascinating, actually. And I was wondering that you showed us that long sort of cylindrical or rod-shaped synthetic vaccine virus-like particle. Viruses have very specific shapes. Have you thought about manipulating the shape of those particles to mimic one of the native viruses' shape in maybe further potentiating or enhancing the immune response you get?
we haven't actually taken any steps toward doing it, but I think there's actually every reason to think it might make a difference. One of my former colleagues at Santa Barbara has been one of the leaders in trying to figure out, not for synthetic vaccines, but for endocytosis and other things, you know, how particle shape matters. And it really does matter. A sphere and a rod, but now let's do it at constant volume so that we're not talking about a sphere and a rod of the same radius. We're talking about a sphere and a rod of the same volume. The rod is more readily taken into cells, which is not the process exactly with, well, it is sort of, I guess, with dendritic cells, but regardless, if a cell can find a smaller cross-section through which to bring it in, it chooses that kind of cross-section preferentially. So I think there's every reason to think that shape could matter in this, and so we should figure that out.
Any more questions? Last question.
This attempted engineering is a change of philosophy somewhat, as you pointed out, and you engineering is the use of science in the society. Is there a policy on implementing this in the society? I mean, well, for example, getting to a clinical stage with this sort of thing. You haven't mentioned any mechanism or policy that will probably be needed to transfer this.
Well, the policies already exist because we wouldn't be doing something that wouldn't fall within the regular university procedures for clinical trials. And there's clinical trials of all sorts of things that go on now. But what it does require is that, you know, we think through protocols that can actually be approved, that minimize danger, that are economical of resources, and those things are held to high scrutiny before you can go to clinical trials. Maybe the more challenging thing about the process of moving things into the world will be how do we interact with companies. And I'm not so concerned about how we interact with big existing companies. The trickier and less familiar thing is starting new companies. And, you know, when does work that's ongoing in your lab cross over to being commercial work? And then if there's commercial work going on, how connected can your lab be? And, you know, university inventors tend to think that they can do everything across the entire spectrum. But at some point, you have to make a clear separation between an organization that's trying to make a product and an organization that's trying to train students and researchers. And we'll have to be careful about those are covered also by processes, but the judgment calls are a little tougher in those cases under the conflict of interest policies and so on. So I think we'll have to work within good conflict of interest policies that enable us to get stuff into the world, but protect the interests of graduate students and postdocs and the university itself that's working on these things.
So thank you very much,
thank
Professor Terrell.
Thank you.